Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation.
You know, I'm amazed the number of patients that come in here that are told that they're crazy, depressed, they have fibromyalgia. And some of those things are blatant. No one's done an animal exposure history.
That was Dr. David Craig Wright, expressing an important fact concerning the diagnosis of Lyme disease and other tick-borne infections. We finally decided to start tackling the issue of Lyme disease on Ask Dr. Dawn. And one of the reasons I have hesitated to do so is because it is so controversial and polarized a field. People on both sides of the spectrum hold passionate viewpoints and argue them very well. The problem is, of course, that they contradict each other. In circumstances like this, where two opposing sides see things very, very differently, I always assume sincerity on the part of the speakers. These are intelligent people, and to me that means that there must be some third variable or other, to this point, unidentified factor, which can allow them to look at the evidence and derive such different conclusions. Today we'll be examining one such hypothesis, namely, that tick-borne illnesses such as Lyme disease are often associated with multiple co-infections that muddy the waters and perhaps even create false positive serologies or blood tests. Probably we don't know enough about what diseases exist in various areas. Spirochetes are a special kind of bacteria that don't always follow the rules of the more common bugs like staph and strep, or even the gram-negative bacteria that we're familiar with from intestinal infections. Some of them have complicated life cycles that require growth outside of the human body and have a host or vector that may infect multiple species. Some of them can lie dormant for long periods of time. And others, if not fully treated, will hibernate for years or even decades before waking up again, a process called recrudescence. Different vectors, like ticks or mosquitoes, have different life cycles and are very specific to specific regions. I was particularly interested in some comments Dr. Wright made about a type of Borrelia that they find in Israel, where it never freezes. When you stop and think about it, our climate in many parts of California has a lot more similarity to that of the Middle East than it does to the northeastern United States, such as Lyme, Connecticut. Some portions of this talk are fairly technical, and I'll try to step in and clarify when we start slinging around multiple initials and lots of terminology. Well, here we go, and I hope you enjoy this edition of Ask Dr. Dawn. So today we're talking to Dr. David Wright, an infectious disease specialist, about chronic Lyme disease and its challenges. I wanted to start off with a biography. Let's start with your training.
I went to University of Virginia as an undergraduate, and then there for medical school. That's in Charlottesville. Then I did an internship in Harlem Hospital in New York City at Columbia P&S. And then after that, it was after the Vietnam War. I owed the government some time. I did 3 years in Germany as just a general medical officer. Then I went back to Walter Reed, then did 2 years of internal medicine, then 3 years of infectious disease training, and then I did some tropical medicine training. During that period, I actually set up the first AIDS clinic at Walter Reed.
You opened the first AIDS clinic at Walter Reed,
yeah.
Did I hear
mm-hmm.
you correctly? What year was that?
That would have been in 83.
When did you first become interested in Lyme disease?
Actually, I've never actually been totally interested in Lyme disease. I'm just a general infectious disease specialist, and I kind of got interested in Borrelia infections actually when I just set up my practice out here, because I kept seeing people with Borrelia infections, but I wasn't seeing a lot of what I would call, y'all would call Lyme disease. I was seeing people that had, instead of Borrelia burgdorferi infection, or one of the infections in the the Lyme disease group, I was seeing patients that had infections in the tick-borne relapsing fever group. In this case, the one I've seen the most of out here is Borrelia hermsii. So that's actually what kind of got me interested in Borrelia in this private practice, is that I realized that lots of the folks that were coming to see me didn't really have Borrelia burgdorferi, but some of them had Borrelia hermsii. And I'm amazed the number of patients that come in here that are told that they're crazy, depressed, they have fibromyalgia, and they're depressed. Patients are told that time after again by physicians. They kind of believe there actually is something wrong with them. You know, maybe the doctor's right and something wrong with them. And some of these things are blatant. No one's done an animal exposure history. No one asks if they have rats in their house, mice in their house. Even if they don't do that, do they see animal droppings in their house? People just don't ask these simple questions to find out whether people have an animal exposure history. Do they have dogs and cats, and do those cats and dogs sleep with them? And do they use any of the medications we have, frontline or other things, to use any of those things to try to keep the tick and flea population down? People just don't ask these patients that. Have you ever had a tick bite with a rash? Okay. People don't ask. And then on the flip side, I want to say one thing about treatment. I don't see a lot of acutely ill people. I see people that are, I'd say, partially treated based on the guidelines. As an example, I have somebody come to see me and they'll say, well, I was treated for Borrelia burgdorferi. It doesn't matter where they're from. They might be back east and they've moved out here. I was treated with Borrelia burgdorferi, but my physician, standard physician, would treat me. I saw a Lyme specialist. And they treated me with ceftriaxone injected intramuscularly or intravenously, 1 or 2 grams, 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Or maybe they might have got it Monday through Friday, but no Saturday and Sunday.
Subtherapeutic treatment?
Subtherapeutic treatment. Okay. Those aren't the guidelines. If you're going to treat someone, if you think someone has a latent Borrelia infection, let's just say it was not picked up acutely for whatever reason, they were never treated, and you think they have a latent Borrelia infection, it doesn't seem reasonable to me that you would tell them they need to be treated 3 or 5 days a week for that. I don't know of any data to support that therapy. What most people would recommend is at least 4 weeks worth of therapy. And you can argue whether that's oral doxycycline or whether that should be ceftriaxone. I have an infusion clinic, so it's very easy for us to treat patients. And the average physician doesn't have access to infusion center and can't do what we can do here. But when I give someone intravenous ceftriaxone, I don't have to worry about whether they took the pills or whether they took the pills with milk. I think probably a month's worth of doxycycline is probably just as good as a month's worth of ceftriaxone. When I have patients with what I think are significant infections with Borrelia hermsii, I actually treat them a little longer and treat them for 6 weeks.
And you treat them Saturday and Sunday as well?
There's no days off. I don't know of a regular bacterial infection that any of us would normally treat. And ourselves or anyone we knew would normally treat that with what I would call intermittent therapy. Now, it is true there's some unusual things where we're doing observed treatment with tuberculosis and some other things where we're doing less than daily therapy occasionally. But that really doesn't, I think, hold water for a lot of these infections. And so what I worry about is whether the patients have been adequately treated based on just the plain old guidelines that exist. And we can argue about whether someone has joint involvement with a Borrelia infection or whether they have neurologic involvement, what those definitions are. But the bottom line is, if you actually think as a clinician that someone has this, why would you not treat your patients optimally?
You make an excellent point.
And that's what I'd kind of like to see. I mean, it's very difficult to figure out when someone comes here 2 or 3 years after it, man. It's very difficult to figure out what they have and what's been done, and records are frequently fragmented. The other thing I see a lot of, and I think it's particularly dangerous, is people are being given clinical diagnoses of what are called co-infections, and they don't have documentation that they actually have that co-infection.
Can you clarify what you mean by a co-infection?
Well, as an example, we know that ticks can carry more than one infection. It's not common, but many people have multiple tick bites, history of multiple tick bites. especially if they're outdoors folks. So one might anticipate that besides having a grueling infection, they might be exposed to all sorts of other tick-borne illnesses, everything from Rocky Mountain spotted fever to, in California here, we have Francisella tularensis.
Babesiosis.
We have babesiosis. We have an unusual strain here. Oh, I wanted to mention that. There are unusual strains of babesia-like organisms found on the West Coast and one other state, Missouri. Okay? The strain in Missouri is called MO1, I think. There are two California strains called CA1 and CA2. And then there's a strain from Washington State called WA1. The assays, when I first moved out here, it was not obvious to the testing, the pathologists in this area, that you needed to do a different assay than the East Coast assay to detect these. The East Coast assays, which are, and this is usually predominantly a northeastern part of the United States, it's called Babesia microti. There's an assay for that, and you have to order that test. That will not exclude a West Coast Babesia-like infection. And you need to order an antibody test for that. And or do serial smears, malaria smears, because the organisms can be seen if you have properly trained pathologists and they've seen some disease. And then they may have some PCR assays and other things that I haven't seen yet. But you can at least order it's called a WA1 strain antibody panel. And that's both an IgG and an IgM test. And that will tell you whether the patient either has had an infection or has antibody evidence of either a present infection or old infection. The treatment is relatively easy for that. It's azithromycin for a week and Mepron for a week. 1 week, not what I'm seeing. I have patients coming in here that have been treating for 6 months. And they don't have the tests that I mentioned, pain positive. So that's not necessary. The treatment for Babesia infections, particularly if it's early, it's not a late disease patient with CNS involvement back east. And I don't know really how much we know about the West Coast diseases, but the treatment for Babesia infections is just a simple week of therapy. A lot of these other things, patients tell me they have Bartonella infection. Well, most of those are a single dose of azithromycin. So this idea that we have to constantly give people huge doses of antibiotics and all the attendant problems associated with that bothers me a bit. And some people might say, well, geez, you're just too much of a plain old infectious disease specialist. And maybe I am. But I think patients are being overtreated and we're seeing complications from some of those therapies. And if you don't know how to treat one of these infections, it's real simple to look it up. Or you could call your local infectious disease specialist and ask them how they would treat it if they had an infection. They may not think you have a patient with the infection, but if you think you do, you could at least call and ask how to treat it. Because I don't always know whether our assays are that good, what I tell patients is that if I do our workup, we do our workup and we don't find anything that I think is treatable, we still continue to follow the patient. Because I learned that early in the AIDS epidemic. We didn't know what was going on. But maybe these patients had something. To just tell them they're depressed and put them on a bunch of antidepressants, it's doing a disservice to the patient, doing a disservice to medicine. We should follow the patients because disease changes with time. New symptoms develop. New assays are available. And one day, if you're diligent in following your patients as a physician, you may be able to figure out what's wrong with that patient. And if you're not, you'll never find out what's wrong with any of your patients. You know, the math is that if I were to see you for the first time, and I do a history and I do a physical and I do the lab work, I'm only going to figure out what's wrong with you probably, if I'm good, 80 or 90% of the time. And that means 10 or 20% of the time, I didn't know what's wrong with you or I was wrong. And, you know, you have an obligation to try to figure that out in that patient, not just tell them that they're crazy.
So I want to make sure that people understand the term infusion.
Sure. Essentially what it means is that we're placing either a catheter or a needle in a vein and administering a fluid that in this case would have an antibiotic in it. As an example, if we were treating a Borrelia burgdorferi for our infection, someone that has CNS involvement, you would want to treat that patient for about 4 weeks with ceftriaxone, 2 grams each day. Now, there are two ways to do that. You can either put a needle in and take that out each day, or you can put a catheter in, what we call a PICC-line, in your arm. We prefer not to do that. PICC-lines are expensive. The patients have all sorts of complications, from secondary infections to clotting off the veins to emboli, pulmonary emboli. And we try to talk all the patients into letting us just stick. We stick a 23-gauge butterfly needle into a vein, usually on their hand, and we do that for the length of the therapy. We don't just do that for Borrelia infections, but other infectious diseases. We see patients with osteomyelitis and need 4 to 6 weeks of antibiotics, try to do the same thing. If it's a 2 or 3 time a day infusion, sometimes we have to use antibiotics, like vancomycin, very hard to give through a peripheral vein, and it has to be administered at least twice a day. In that setting, we almost have to use a PICC-line in the patient. That would be for treatment of osteomyelitis or methicillin-resistant Staph aureus infection. But in general, we try not to use the PICC-lines because they're expensive and have complications. And that kind of separates us out a little differently than everyone else because we take the time to do that. The average infusion, we do things a little bit more slowly. The average patient is here about an hour. You know, we think that humor and music are part of the healing process, and so we try to provide a little bit of that for every patient. We like to have the patient smiling when they leave.
I think that's a wonderful idea.
So we firmly believe in that.
Let's take a moment, just for the sake of compare and contrast, to do an overview of Lyme disease and as it's currently understood or accepted.
You know, I actually don't talk about Lyme disease. I talk about the organisms that cause the infection. For instance, there are 14 different Borrelia in the Lyme disease family, okay? Mm-hmm. And there are probably an equal number of Borrelia in the tick-borne relapsing fever group, so they're totally separate. They have some genes in common, the BDR gene sequence, so they have some common protein sequence in common, but they're actually different. They're carried by different ticks. Usually, the tick-borne relapsing fever organisms are predominantly carried by the soft-bodied ticks, which feed for 15 to 30 minutes. They're very small and usually associated in mountainous areas out west here. And then the Borrelia burgdorferi-like isolates or group are more likely carried by hard-bodied ticks, much more common on the east coast than on the west coast. And there's a lot of genetic variability. There's just a paper out of Berkeley where they looked at, I think it was 114 people in coastal California, and 27 of them, of the 114, or 23%, were actually infected with a spirochete that's more like Borrelia bassetti, which is more commonly seen in Europe. Mm. Okay. And this wasn't an antibody test. They're actually using a sensitive PCR assay, so they're not looking for just antibodies in organisms. The importance of that is that in California and everywhere else, we're finding new Borrelia species, and many of them probably aren't going to be Borrelia burgdorferi. And therefore, if you're just doing tests for Borrelia burgdorferi, you're going to miss some of these other Borrelia infections.
What are the important reasons that we wouldn't want to do that?
Well, we don't know the natural history of all Borrelia infections are. We know pretty much about the acute infection that occurs with Borrelia hermsii, and we know pretty much about the acute, subacute, and neurologic forms or latent forms of Borrelia burgdorferi, but some of these other isolates we just don't know that much about. The bassetti-like isolates that we're seeing in California are probably going to act similarly to some of the bassetti-like isolates that are in Europe, and so we know something about those things, but every time we find a new organism that infects humans, we can't presume that everything that we see in that particular organism is going to be relevant to one of the other organisms we've found. So I kind of like to think of the Borrelia as even though you can group them into the two major groups, we really don't know that much about, particularly the tick-borne relapsing fever group. The thousands of articles written around Borrelia burgdorferi or Borrelia burgdorferi-like isolates, but there's only 240 publications at all on the tick-borne relapsing fever group.
I want to bring it around a little bit as a practical clinician. Primary care, so simple. I like it simple. They're all spirochetes. They're all tick-borne. Spirochetes as a class of organisms have interesting properties in that they're able to achieve long-term latency, and some of them at least have an affinity for the central nervous system, syphilis being sort of the classic bite you on the behind 30 years after you were infected disease. That being said, they all tend to be quite responsive to antibiotics, and the Borrelia groups, as near as I can tell, all respond to the same bag of antibiotics, common antibiotic therapies.
Sure.
So if you treat for one, even if it's a misdiagnosis, tree falls in a forest, you know, does it really matter?
I agree with that. I think in general, if you treat these infections with either high-dose doxycycline or with ceftriaxone, if it's a later stage in the illness, I think those probably, they will treat all the Borrelia infections. I don't think we know yet of failures using those therapeutic modalities. By failure, I would say you've treated someone for the appropriate period of time, depending upon where they are in the illness, and then you re-isolate the organism or have a positive PCR. And I don't know of documented treatment failures.
I want to underscore that, re-isolate the organism or have a positive PCR, because the persistence of antibodies does not tell you that you have a treatment failure.
No, it doesn't. Some people would say that if you have, let's just say you draw a serum specimen on a patient, and that if you have a fourfold rise, say a month later or 2 months later, people would suggest that that might be indicative of actually another infection, maybe
a reinfection.
It could be a reinfection. I don't think that would be a recrudescence of the original infection, unless the patient wasn't treated properly. As an example, what if you give a patient doxycycline for their therapy and they decide to take it with milk? And that's one of the problems with oral therapy. Your patient may take all the pills, but do they take the pills with their meals, or do they take it with milk or something else that might bind the agent? So you have to make sure when you're treating folks that they actually are going to take the pills at the appropriate times, and they take all of their pills. And I think if they do that, not only can you treat infections, but you can prevent infections. The Israelis did a wonderful study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. They have a different type of Borrelia, but it's in the Lyme disease group. It's called Borrelia pisetti, I think that's how they pronounce it. And they showed that just someone comes in with a tick bite, if you give them two doxycycline tablets, and then every day after that, that's two 100 milligram tablets. And then if you give them 100 milligrams every day for four consecutive days, you can prevent 100% of the infections. They have a very high attack rate over there from their tick bites. I think it was about 20 or 25%.
Do you think that the recommendations that the CDC currently has that say that we should not be treating tick infections in California prophylactically by that therapy or other therapies is correct, or do you disagree?
Actually, I wasn't aware that the CDC said that we couldn't prophylactically treat patients.
Guidelines discourage prophylactic.
Well, they may discourage it, but particularly here, we're seeing some interesting things to include relapsing fever organisms. I prophylax patients. I think if you think the ticks might be infected, then I think it makes sense to treat. Now, obviously, there's some problems around here with infected ticks. They have 114 patients up in Berkeley. So I think there are significant numbers of Borrelia infections. Not arguing about which species it is, whether it's Hermsii or Myomatoi or Procuri or Borrelia burgdorferi, or whether it's this Borrelia bisettii. So forgetting about what people actually have.
Right.
If you think there's a problem, I think six total tablets of doxycycline is relatively benign.
What about the possibility that by treating early, you might cause that person to be a seronegative chronic Lyme disease? Is there any real fear of that?
There isn't any evidence that I know of in the Israeli studies in their country. And the type of study that I just outlined, as far as I know, has not been done in the United States, the Israeli study on prophylaxing folks. And it was felt important enough that it was actually published in the New England Journal of Medicine, so that doesn't tell you, the way the study was designed, it doesn't tell you whether two tablets and then maybe one tablet for 2 days might work rather than 4 days. But I think as a clinician, when you see a patient, and if you're concern that you do have Borrelia infections in your community, I think it's reasonable for you to make that decision to prophylax someone. It's relatively inexpensive, usually not associated with even minor complications like vaginal overgrowth with Candida. So I would prophylax someone who came in with a tick in my office here.
Of course, we know that many people with proven Lyme disease, or I'm sure Borrelia hemsia or other borreliosis, will not recall a tick bite.
That's correct, especially if they're one of the soft-bodied ticks, because they don't feed for very long. Those are usually found on small mammals, too, like mice and rats. And I think it's important, actually, to ask people if they have mice or rat exposure. Many of the patients you see who have these problems, you'll find they have mice in the garage or their attics or rats. And it's important, I think, to make sure that you don't have rodents in the house.
In the next section, we'll be discussing how we determine what kind of bacteria are infecting a patient. In order to make that a little easier to follow, let me define a few terms for you. First of all, ELISA, IFA, and Western blot are all immune tests looking for surface markers, which are unique and complex molecules displayed on the surface of bacteria. In other words, those barcodes on the surface of bacterial cells that I'm always talking about. ELISA stands for Enzyme-Linked Immunosorbent Assay. IFA is immunofluorescent antibody testing. And in both of these, the existence of immune globulins in the serum of the patient being tested attaches to antigens. So in other words, when we're looking to see if you've been exposed and therefore have antibodies to something, that unique something is technically called an epitope. We put that something out there in the breeze and let antibodies in your serum blow by it. And the antibodies that have the right shape are able to attach and stick. We can then measure them through the use of other antibodies, which are trained to attack antibodies. So those anti-antibodies, some of them glow in the dark, some of them have an enzyme that causes a color change, and hence the various different terms. In the case of the Western blot, the immune antibody complex is actually pushed electrically through a piece of blotter paper and produces a pattern of bands. The bands migrate in the electric field in proportion to how big they are. So you'll often hear about a 42 kilodalton band or a 39 kilodalton band. When you hear about bands measured in weight, you know you're talking about a Western blot test. As I said, all of these immune tests look at the surface markers or barcodes. The other test that we sometimes do is called PCR. This is a test that looks for genes, specifically DNA. It's called polymerase chain reaction, or PCR for short. Because PCR looks at specific strings of DNA, it is extremely specific. And because the DNA is first amplified before being looked for, it is very, very sensitive.
Speaking of serology, as we had spoken on the phone and you had educated me a little bit about the epitopes that are used for Lyme disease testing.
Yeah.
Would you give us a brief survey of the serological testing that's currently done for Lyme disease, both to confirm or refute a diagnosis and its limitations?
Sure. In the first place, we don't have a lot of tests, but the tests we do have are ELISAs and Western blots. And an ELISA is basically a screening test. We actually have two different types of ELISAs. We have ELISAs that use specific peptides, and the one that was developed for use in the vaccine trials is called the Borrelia burgdorferi C6 peptide antibody test. That's C6 peptide antibody test. And it's available from all of the local testing labs like Quest and LabCorp. It turns out that Borrelia burgdorferi sensiolata, the original isolate, that isolate has that peptide sequence on it. And the vaccine that was developed did not have that sequence because it was just the OPSA protein. So we could vaccinate folks, and then the way you could tell they were infected is if they got an infection, they would develop antibody to the C6 peptide. If they were vaccinated, they'd make antibody to the OPSA, so you couldn't actually use that. But so that's why the assay was originally developed. Mm-hmm. Okay, and there are a lot of other new assays in development that are specific for different Borrelia species using that same principle. But in general, most physicians probably won't know about the C6 peptide assay, won't order that. If somebody came in with symptoms they thought might be consistent with Lyme disease, let's just say they had erythema chronica migrans or a rash that was...
No, let's say they didn't. Let's say that they have is fatigue and odd pains.
Oh, yeah. Let's yeah.
That's the patient.
And that's the tough.
That's the patient.
Okay.
That's the one.
And if they don't have frank arthritis, okay, most people would question what they actually have.
No redness, okay. No swelling, nothing.
Yeah,
to
if they don't have arthritis and they don't have symptoms that would make you think of CNS involvement, those are tough patients. And you do see patients like that that have chronic fatigue. I think it's reasonable to at least see if they've been exposed to Borrelia burgdorferi. And the simplest thing to do is just to do the screening, regular available ELISA assay. And if they have a Borrelia burgdorferi infection, those are frequently positive. Okay?
70% of the time.
Yeah, well, it's a screening test.
You can't prove a negative. Yeah, that's really where we're going with this.
But if they are positive, let's just presume they are positive.
Okay.
Then what's supposed to happen, the lab frequent will reflex to a Western blot,
right,
even if the physician has not requested it. And they'll do two different types of Western blots. Usually they'll do an IgM Western blot and an IgG Western blot. And there are various criteria that were set up, you know, in 1999, I think, actually, for what a positive test is. And basically, you have to have 2 out of 3 bands for a positive IgM Western blot and at least 5 bands for a positive IgG blot.
Can you explain what a band is?
Yeah, it's simple, kind of simple, actually. You grow an organism up, okay, and then you usually mix that organism with some SDS and heat it and then load that into a polyacrylamide gel, and then run an electric current, which then separates the various proteins based on molecular weight on that gel. Then we put a piece of nitrocellulose up against the gel, and then run a current through the gel, driving the proteins onto the nitrocellulose. And then that is cut into strips, and then your sera is incubated at a certain dilution with the strip, and you do 2 strips for each person. You come back with 1 strip with an antibody that has an IgG label. It's an IgG-labeled antibody and one that's an IgM-labeled antibody. And then after that's incubated for a while, you wash that off, and then you come back with a reagent that will recognize that antigen-antibody complex if it exists, and it's usually colorimetric, usually a blue or black or a red color based on whichever dye we use to in the process. And then you have to have X number of those bands. In the case of Borrelia burgdorferi, you have to have 5 bands on your IgG Western blot, 5 or more bands.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the criteria that have been set up. Blots are frequently graded as a strongly positive band, a weakly positive band, or no band, okay? But a band is a band from my perspective. If there's a band there, you have antibody to the band. Remembering that whatever dilution, the dilution of the serum could determine how much antibody is actually allowed to bind to the protein band. And even the time, that there are a lot of variables, okay? And all of these things are supposedly standardized by the companies to do them.
Mm-hmm.
So assuming everything is done correctly, the right dilution of serum is used, then the results we get will tell us, you know, one way or the other, whether you have 1, 2, 3, 5 bands or more.
A lot of people
there's some false positive things, just to go over those. You really need to test each person for syphilis. You usually do a screening test and RPR, because there are common sequences. All of these organisms, all the different Borrelia, are part of the same family. They probably at one time even had some common, probably 30 or 40 million years ago, maybe had a common ancestor, a bacterial ancestor. They have some common genes across the Borrelia species. This BDR gene sequences are very important, codes for certain proteins. And if you make antibodies to one of the isolates, and then react that with antibody to any other Borrelia isolate, you'll see bands. And that's because they all have these BDR gene sequence coded proteins.
So they have a family resemblance.
They have family resemblance. And that's actually one of the things I worry about. Let's say you do a Borrelia burgdorferi Western blot. And let's say you see just antibody to the OPC protein. So let's just say you see that band. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that the patient has made antibody to a sequence that's common on the OPC protein. Could they have another Borrelia infection that's not burgdorferi? Well, we don't know the answer to that right now. But clearly, the Borrelia bassetti isolates would be OPC positive, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It gets even more complex when you're looking at the flagellar antigen. The most common band we see as a single band positive on a blot would be the 41,000 molecular weight, the 41 KD kilodalton band. Now, that band is frequently positive. You occasionally see it in people that have multiple sclerosis. You occasionally see it in people that have been immunized with influenza or had influenza infection. There are a few other reasons that band can be positive. But that codes for the flagellar antigen. And since all of these organisms have flagellar antigens, it's possible there can be some cross-reactivity through Borrelia strains. So if you have, as an example, an IgG Western blot that had antibody to the 41 kilodalton protein and antibody to the OPC, and I'm just talking about an IgG response, that's two bands that could be found on other Borrelia. And since you don't have a Western blot to all the Borrelia, how do we know that some of these patients don't have Borrelia infections? That's the question, okay? What we need to kind of figure out what's going on is better assays and assays for the other Borrelia isolates. If we have 14 different Lyme-like organisms, Borrelia burgdorferi-like organisms, we need more tests. We need better tests. We need antigen capture assays that obviously have been developed and are being used in university settings like at Berkeley now. We need those things available for clinicians. Those assays need to get from the universities to the contract testing labs that all of us have. You know, I live in a rural county. Your county is a little bit rural too. We're trying to take care of patients, and yet we don't have the access to the 21st century tests that we need to actually look at our patients. If we have better tests where we can actually find the actual antigen from the organisms in the blood or the cerebrospinal fluid of patients, we can clarify some of these issues that I think are a little cloudy. And I'm speaking actually just as a clinician, just sitting in a little office by myself, you know, in a rural county. We need access to better assays. But as an example, just switching gears to Borrelia hermsii now, talking about those assays. Now, most doctors don't even know there's any assay for the tick-borne relapsing fever organisms.
No.
Now, and the only one we have right this minute is an indirect fluorescent antibody assay, an IFA. Now, that can be ordered through your hospital laboratory. It's called a Borrelia hermsii IFA, and they'll do an IgM test and an IgG test. Now, that's an indirect fluorescent antibody test. Means that someone is reading those slides to see if there's fluorescence. They've taken the organism, fix that down on the slide, and come back with the patient's sera, and then come back with a fluorescent-labeled anti-IgG or IgM. And then a technician reads that slide, and a positive in that test, to make it specific for that organism, you have to have an antibody dilution of greater than 1 to 64. In other words, if the test were positive at 1 to 32, they would not call that a positive test.
Right.
Okay. So they've made a test that's probably fairly specific. Well, the question is whether it's sensitive enough. Well, by the way, and I didn't mention that. I'll talk a little bit more about Borrelia hermsii, but I didn't mention the fact that since most of the tests we're doing are dependent on people making an antibody response, it probably is a good idea, particularly if you're dealing with an older patient, to make sure that they can make an antibody response, i.e. that they have normal levels of IgG, IgA, and IgM. If they don't, you can't necessarily expect they're going to have an optimal response. And so so people need to take that into consideration. Is my patient hypogammaglobulinemic, as an example? And if they are, they might have an impaired IgM or IgG response, which is all we really look for. Now, getting back to Brulia-Hermsia, so all we really have right now is the one test, the IFA. We have no confirmatory test. A confirmatory test does exist at the CDC laboratory in Colorado, but I don't think that's readily available to clinicians. And there's no commercial equivalent of the Borrelia-Burgdorferi Western blot for Brulia-Hermsia, and no tests for any of the other Borrelia available to any of us.
In preparation for this, I went and looked up Borrelia-Hermsia, and it's described as a relapsing fever with fever, headache, and muscle pains lasting up to every 10 days. Then it goes away for 6 days. Then it comes back. Now, that's very distinct as a symptom profile from what we would expect with Lyme disease, which is a transient flu-like illness followed by, from months to years later, the eruption of arthritis, cardiac issues, and central nervous system issues. So do you believe that there is a different version of relapsing fever that is perhaps more subtle and still clinically significant that could be masquerading as Lyme disease in many of the people who've been so diagnosed, or are they just a serological false diagnosis?
Yeah, I'm not actually sure what's going on with the patients we see. I've only seen one child and one adult that had a positive IgM test. In other words, when we do the Brulia-Hermsia assay, they do an IgM assay, which has to be greater than 1 to 16 or equal to 1 to 16 on that assay. And then we do an IgG test, which has to be greater than 1 to 64.
And you're referring to the IFA test here?
IFA test.
Yes, go ahead.
I've only seen two people that had a positive IgM test, and one was a 14-year-old child. And she actually turned out to actually have had a rash, a bullseye rash, about a month earlier. So we're pretty sure when she got infected, and we're actually pretty sure when she became symptomatic, because she did not have classic tick-borne relapsing fever. That's a rapid onset of the febrile response after the bite, because she had a rash a month earlier. So I'm not sure if what we're seeing out here and the patients that are referred to me, and I have patients that are referred from the mountainous areas in California where we might expect to see this, to patients that just live here and have not been anywhere else. And I'm not sure whether we're seeing the classic Brulia-Hermsia, which has been described in the mountainous areas with an acute onset, or whether we're seeing something different, or whether perhaps it might even be another Borrelia that's just cross-reacting in the IFA with Brulia-Hermsia. I think the county is actually trying to sort this out in a few of the patients we've seen with some other tests. But I'm convinced there are other Borrelia infections in California other than just Borrelia-Burgdorferi. I think there's clearly in any of the mountainous areas of California, to include, there was an outbreak reported in L.A. County worked up by the government a couple of years ago. So we know that the mountain areas of L.A. County have this, as an example. And we certainly have some mountains here in the Big Sur area. And I'm not convinced that we don't have a Brulia-Hermsia-like organism on the coastal areas of California.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that paper I mentioned out of Berkeley, their probes were not looking at the tick-borne relapsing fever organisms. They were only looking for Brulia-Burgdorferi-like organisms, so they wouldn't have been looking for this agent.
I came across something that suggested a concept I'd like to bounce off of you. This has to do with the idea that there's a permissive host. There's an individual who, perhaps because of their immune system or because of their HLA antigens, may manifest a disease differently. And the suggestion with respect to my reading on the Borrelias was that people who have a DR4 antigen can develop a persistent arthritis. And I'm wondering if some of the people who have come to me over the years and said something like, I have Lyme disease, it keeps coming back, I'll do months of antibiotics, and then I'll be fine, and then it'll come back again. And almost all of those patients, and it's a small number, maybe three or four, their symptoms are fatigue and arthritis and have an autoimmune smell to them as opposed to, you know, the rash or the carditis.
We know, as an example, just vaccinating people with OPSA can cause a reactive arthritis, right? That's why there's no decent vaccine.
OPSE.
The OPSE protein.
Would be a vaccine for?
Burgdorferi.
For Burgdorferi. Okay.
We don't have a vaccine that's approved because the OPSE protein causes symptoms.
We did have a vaccine in the early 2000s, but it died without a trace.
It died because there were complications from the vaccination. Okay.
So it caused reactive arthritis.
It causes some reactive arthritis. I think some of the patients, I have to go back and pull the trial, may have had some CNS problems as well. Now, there's another point. Just because someone's had an infection and it's been treated does not necessarily mean that the symptoms they have are because the infection wasn't treated properly. The patient's immune system may have a persistent, continued response. As an example, there's a wonderful study. I think this was done actually with Borrelia hermsii and mouse knockout model in the last couple of years. And what they basically showed, you could take mice that had an intact T-cell system and then take mice that had non-intact T-cell system. You can give them both Borrelia infections. They'll both get the Borrelia infection. CNS lesions will only occur in the mice that have the intact T-cell system. In other words, this is kind of like the MS story. I'm not saying that this has anything to do with MS, but you have T cells in those lesions in those patients' brain that are present, okay? And I think maybe the same thing may be going on in Borrelia infections. So if you have an intact immune system, or maybe even an overactive immune system, it might be that you'd be predisposed to what I would call a reactive arthritis. It doesn't mean that you still have organisms in the joint. And it doesn't mean you have organisms in your brain either, okay? It just may be, in essence, an immunologic attack from having the infection. And we've known infections for many years about reactive arthropathies that occur after people have infections. So that's not a totally new concept. And I would propose that may be happening in some of these patients. But the other thing I really worry about is, let's just say you have someone who's living in an area where they have lots of rats and ground squirrels and mice, and they have continued exposure to those, and they've gotten infected, let's just say, with a Borrelia hermsii-like isolate. Well, they're just as likely to get another isolate, okay? Just as likely to get another infection. And the question is, how do you sort that out? And particularly if they have an antibody response. Since we do not have good assays for detecting antigen that are available to all of us, available to you in your practice or me in my practice, can't order one, okay? How are we going to find those patients? They're living in the same environment where they got this once before, and they get another bite. And the only thing we have now to look at is whether they have a fourfold or greater rise in their antibody assay. So what I think you probably need to do with the patients you follow is occasionally do an IFA, as an example, to Borrelia burgdorferi or Borrelia hermsii, or whatever assay you have available. Occasionally do one and see whether it's positive. And if it is positive, collect a convalescent serum a month later and see if you've got a fourfold rise. If you do, you probably have a new infection. Okay, but the problem is, once someone's had one infection, how are we going to sort that out? And the other thing you have to remember is there are lots of other tick-borne illnesses here and in other areas, and physicians have to be aware of those things and the tests that are available. Just to give you an example, there are antibody assays for Anaplasma phagocytophyllum, for Ehrlichia chaffensis, for Francisella tularensis, for Bartonella species, two of the five. Those are all available from your reference laboratories from Focus. Well, Focus is owned by Quest and also from LabCorp. They both have good infectious disease groups that have developed and standardized these assays, and they're available. And then we also, people forget, these are ticks, and we've got lots of rickettsioses in California as well, too. And so they're a whole panel. You can just order a rickettsia panel, and they'll check the patients to see if they have antibody to Rocky Mountain spotted fever or any of the other rickettsial diseases. And there are even flea-borne rickettsial diseases. People forget cat rickettsiosis, which is not as serious normally. It's carried by cat fleas, and folks that are perhaps sleeping, have animals sleeping in bed with them. If they're not doing the tick and flea treatments as required, keeping the animals clean. They're at risk to pick up both flea-borne and tick-borne illnesses from their cats and dogs. So there's a lot of things for someone to think about when someone comes in with a tick bite, particularly if they're symptomatic. As an example, if I see a patient that comes in with or without a tick bite, or with or without a rash, that has a headache and a fever and myalgias, that's the hallmark. Those are the hallmark symptoms for Rocky Mountain spotted fever. It can be spotless or it can be early. Now, you can go ahead and do the serologies, but the acute serologies may be negative. Those patients, either back east where I used to live in Maryland, Virginia, or out west here, those patients need to be treated with doxycycline. You can do the acute serology, and then you can do the convalescent serology a month later, but you need to sort through those things. What I worry about is that people are actually missing tick-borne illnesses because they're not doing the appropriate studies.
Oh, I think we probably are. Based, certainly based on that as a criteria, because to me that sounds like influenza.
It does, except influenza is a cough.
Right, no pulmonary symptoms.
Yes, usually what separates, not always, but usually what separates the two is a cough. But if you can't be sure, and especially out here, you know, our tick-borne season is year-round. It's not like back east where it's less a problem in the winter, usually, to sort through these things. But out here, we really don't have a winter, and so you have to worry more about these things.
You make an excellent point. At the end of these interviews, particularly one as interesting as this, I feel like we've covered so much territory, and yet I know we've only scratched the surface. Is there anything that you would like to say to the audience as a take-home?
If anyone, you know, any person thinks that they have a tick-borne illness, they ought to try to find someone that's familiar with the tick-borne illnesses that are seen in their area and make sure that they get an adequate workup. That may be hard to do because a lot of physicians don't feel that there are tick-borne illnesses in California. And I think that's not true, and I think they need to keep looking. The patients that get here frequently have done that. It's taken them a while to find this place. But I think they need to find someone who's interested in tick-borne illnesses and knows how to adequately assess them, whether they do or don't have an infection.
Well, Dr. David Wright, I'm certainly glad I found you to have this discussion.
Thank you.
We have a couple of minutes left, so here's a couple of recent medical news items.
First of all, on that pesky XMRV virus that last year, in a very splashy announcement, was associated with chronic fatigue syndrome, the data is accumulating that this is just another cold fusion. In other words, a piece of promising and interesting research that nobody else could replicate in their labs. Furthermore, a European research team this week reported going after people who had tested positive for XMRV in the original study and retesting them. Unfortunately, they were unable to find any trace of XMRV in these people's bloodstreams, suggesting that, in fact, it was lab contamination that caused the problem. One last tidbit. Car seat guidelines have just been updated, and the rules are so complicated, I thought I'd give you a couple of numbers just to remember. 35 and 49. So, children need to remain in a backward-facing car seat until they are 35 pounds. Let's just remember the number 35. It's better than thinking age 1, age 2. Secondly, older children need to remain in booster seats until they are 4 foot 9 inches. So let's just remember 35 and 49 as the markers that your children need to pass before they change into the next configuration. Well, we've come to the end of another hour of Ask Dr. Don. I hope you found it interesting. I'm sure that some of you will have comments that you'd like to make about this program. We invite your commentary, but please do realize that anything you can do to help support your viewpoint by references to the scientific literature increases the probability that your commentary will be read on the air. I guess that's about it for this week. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.